Hi, everyone. We are going to get started. I think people are still going to be filtering in, but in the interest of time, so we can get you guys out of here on time, we're going to start. So welcome to CS50 Quiz Zero Review. For those of you who haven't realized yet, you have a quiz on Wednesday. Woo! If you haven't started studying yet or haven't realized that this exists yet, past quizzes and all information about your quiz are on cs50.net/quizzes. There's some pretty good stuff on there. Past quizzes from the last like 10 years, as well as information about this quiz and topics that will be covered. So let's get started. So you guys might remember the first day of class, David had those lamps on. So essentially everything that goes on underneath the hood of a computer is done in binary. Binary means what it sounds like, zeros and ones. It has two values that can be represented. And so, just like in the first day of section, when David turned on a light bulb to represent on or one, our computer understands binary as zeros and ones, on or off. Basics of binary, we have every decimal place, or every place is represented in base 2. So you have 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2, all the way up. To calculate what your binary is to decimal, you just follow this like equation type thing. If you have a 1 in any of those places, you multiply it by whatever base it's in, add it up, and you get the decimal version. So this is how you count to 5 in binary. Just like what we were doing on the last slide, this is how you would represent 1 through 5. Similarly, just like you can add and subtract in decimal or base 10 or really any base, you can add and subtract in binary. Exactly what you would expect when you add the 2 up. If it equals a 1, greater than 1, you carry a 1, make it a 0, and do the addition that way, just like you would expect with regular decimal or any other base. Cool. So like I said before, everything that goes on under the hood of our computer is done in zeros and ones or binary. So how do we express, for example, letters or numbers or characters? And the answer to that is ASCII. ASCII is a mapping between characters that we would normally see in the English language, like A's, B's, C's, underscore, dashes, anything like that. And it maps that to an ASCII value. ASCII value, just a number that can be understood by our computer. And just like you can do addition and subtraction with numbers, you can do them with ASCII values. So in this example, what will this print out? So just A space B space C space D. And notice that you can, where did my mouse go? Okay. Notice you can, define an int as 65. And when you print that out using percent %C, it'll interpret that as a character and will print out A. Similarly, you can declare it as a char. And when you print it out using percent %C, it'll interpret that as percent %D. And just like you can add a number, you can add characters or ASCII values in this case. So a little pointer for everybody. 5 as a string does not actually equal 5. So how might we convert the string 5 to the integer 5? Any ideas? So if we have 5 as a string, we can subtract 0, and that'll give us 5. And similarly, if we have 5 as an integer, add that to the string 0, and that gives us the string 5. Cool. Now recall back to lecture 1, where we talked about algorithms. So how do we actually want a computer to do interesting things? You know, just adding and subtracting numbers, printing things out, not that exciting. Usually, you know, we want our computer to perform some kind of algorithm, something a little more complex than just simple arithmetic. An algorithm, just a step-by-step set of instructions for how to perform a certain task. Oops. Just like a recipe. You might remember the first day of class where David had us count a room of people and how many people were in the room. You might be used to counting one by one, one, two, three, four, in that case a linear time algorithm. But David introduced an algorithm for you to count the people in the room where, you know, everyone stands up, you say your number to another person, add that number up, and one person sits down, and you repeat that. That's one type of algorithm. We can analyze how efficient an algorithm is based on, like, its runtime, but we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So all algorithms can also be written in pseudocode. Pseudocode is just an English-like syntax used to represent a programming language. For example, if we wanted to ask a user to guess my favorite number, we might have pseudocode as such. Get a user's guess. If the guess is correct, tell them they're correct. Else, tell them they're not correct. And pseudocode is a way of easily representing like an idea or an algorithm. So now we might want to actually write this in a language that the computer might understand. So we could write our pseudocode and interpret that into source code. So far, source code must adhere to like a certain syntax of a programming language. And so far in CS50, we've been using mostly C. So this might be like source code for C. Later on in the course, you might come into contact with other programming languages like PHP, or if you even take other classes, you might do Java, Python, or even OCaml. But in our C programming language, this is how we might write the source code for the pseudocode algorithm that I just described earlier. So how does your computer actually understand that? Like I said before, it only really understands zeros and ones. So how does it get from the source code to something that can be understood? Well, we have something called a compiler. If you recall back in most of your PSETs, you had some kind of program written in a .c file, and then you would type make. So what is make doing? Make is because you can type make to compile your program because someone, whoever wrote your PSET, probably David, created a make file. And that tells make to know to run your compiler called clang that will then compile your source code to object code, which is zeros and ones that your computer understands. But a little later on, we will go more in depth about compilers. So recall PSET 0, where, yes, you have a question? Yes, I think they actually should be online. It is not. They are on cs50.net/quizzes.
/quizzes/2013/0. If you just click through quizzes 2013/0 for new session slides.
Yeah. So if you guys want to pull it up and look at it on your own computer, that's fine too. Say that again? Yeah, food is just a dummy variable. So PSET 0, you guys all, oh yes. No, structs are not on the exam. Sorry, her question was structs on the exam, and it is not. So PSET 0, you guys might or should have all implemented something using Scratch. And we learned some basic programming building blocks using Scratch. So let's take a look at some of these building blocks that make up a program. First is Boolean expressions. Boolean expressions are ones and zeros, or anything that has two possible values. In this case, you know, true or false, on or off, yes or no. An example of a simple, very simple Boolean program, or program that uses a Boolean expression up here. So in order for Boolean expressions to be useful, we have Boolean operators. These are operators that can be used to compare certain values. So we have and, or, not equal to, less than or equal to, greater than or equal to, less than or greater than. But these operators aren't very useful unless we can combine them into conditions. So you guys might remember from Scratch and from your PSETs, we had conditions. They're essentially like forks in the logic of your program that execute depending on whether a condition is met. So, you know, one of the conditions that we have used many times in this course is the if, else, if, and else conditions. Here's an example of how you might use that. Does anyone know kind of like the difference between just using if statements all the way down versus if, else, if, and else, like combined? Yes. Exactly. So if I had if all the way down this way, even if it returns, or even if this condition returns true, it'll still continue testing the next two. Whereas with an else if and else statement, if the one returns true, the others are not tested. Any questions about that? Cool. So you might use an if, else if, and else statement if you know that like it can only be one of these cases. So we know like if x is greater than 0, it's definitely not going to be, or if x is less than 0, it's definitely not going to be greater than 0. Next, another building block that we learned are loops. We have three types of loops: for loops, while loops, and do while loops. And generally, you know, when you sit down to write something, you kind of have to decide which of the three you want to use. So how do we decide which one? We generally use a for loop if we know how many times we want to iterate through something or how many times we want to perform a task. We use while loops if we need some condition to be true to be to keep running. And we use do while if, very similar to while, but we want our code to run at least one time. So do while, whatever is in the do will always run at least one time. Whereas with a while, it may not run at all if the condition is not satisfied. Any questions with that? Cool. So structure of a for loop. You guys have all seen this. You initialize it. You have some kind of condition. So for example, if, you know, or we might initialize as for I equals 0, I is less than 10, and I plus plus. Very simple one that we've done. For a while loop, similarly, you have to have some kind of initialization, some kind of condition, and some kind of update. So we could implement our for loop also as a while loop using this. And similarly with a do while loop, we might have some initialization, execute something, update it, and then check the condition. Awesome. So now functions. When we put everything together, we might want to write some kind of function. Common function that you might have seen already, main. Main is a function. It has a return type, int. It has a function name, main. And it has arguments, argc and argv. So main is just a function. Other functions you might have used, printf. Printf is a function. Getint, toUpper. But these happen to have been implemented for us by some kind of library. If you guys remember, including the cs50.h library or the standard IO library. Yes, question.
Is main just inherent in C? Does it just kind of exist out there? You don't need a library for it?
The question is if main is inherent in C, and yes, all functions have a main function. It's kind of necessary for the computer to know like where to start running the code.
So you wouldn't need a library if you
start? No. Any other questions? So just like you can use a function that's written for you, you can also write your own function. This is a function that someone might have written to calculate the volume of a cube, for example. There's a return type here, in this case int, our function name cube, and our list of parameters. And note that you have to write the data type of the parameter you want to use, or else the function doesn't know like what kind of parameter should I be accepting. So in this case, we want an integer as our input. So why might we want to use functions? First of all, great for organization. They help break up your code into more organized chunks, make it easier to read. Simplification, this is good for design. When you're reading a piece of code and the main function is really, really long, it might be harder to reason about what's going on. So if you break it down into functions, it might be easier to read. And reusability, if you have a chunk of code that's being called or run multiple times, instead of rewriting that code like 10 times in your main function, you might want to reuse it. And then every time you need to use that piece of code, call the function. Cool. So now if we remember back to Scratch, we also talked about a few concepts, one of which is threading. Threads are, it's the concept of, multiple sequences of code executing at the same time. So think back to day one, where David had you guys count off the number of people in the room. Essentially, what was going on is all of you guys were running separate threads. And those threads were coming together to get some kind of answer. Similarly, in Scratch, when you have multiple sprites, you might have, a cat and a dog. And they would be simultaneously running their own scripts. That is an example of threading. And the other concept that was introduced in Scratch was events. And events are, when multiple parts of your code communicate with each other. In Scratch, this was when you use the broadcast control and the when I receive blocks. And also in problem set 4, we kind of saw a little bit of events as well. You guys might have used the gevent library. And there was the function wait for click, in which you were waiting for the user to click. And your click in this case would be the event. And wait for click is your event handler. And also throughout running your psets and working on your psets, you might have come into contact with some of these commands. This is what you typed into your terminal window or whatever window that shows up on your gedit. To essentially navigate your computer. So, for example, ls lists the contents of a directory. Make directory creates a new folder. Cd change directory. Rm remove deletes a file or some directory. And then remove directory removes a directory. Yeah, sure. I don't know how much of this, the question was if you would suggest, putting this on the cheat sheet. It could help. If you have room, you can put it on. It's also, just generally good stuff to remember, because when you use it, you might want to just have it memorized. That'll make your life a lot easier. Does that answer your question? So now, we talked a little bit briefly about libraries, but the two main ones that we've been using so far in the course are Standard I.O. and CS50. What kinds of things are included in the Standard I.O. library? Yeah, so far we've used, printf. In CS50, we've used getInt and getString, and the data type string also happens to be declared in the CS50 library. We'll talk a little more in depth about how libraries work and how they interact with the rest of your code, but those are the two main ones that we have come in contact with so far in the course. Types. These are good to remember, how much each type is represented by, or how many bytes each type is of space each type requires. Int 4 bytes, char 1 byte, float is 4 bytes. What is a double? Yeah, so a float, but double the size. What about a long? Okay. What is a long? Yeah, double an int. Long is double in it. And then a long is double that.
No, a long is just an int.
It depends on the architecture, but for the
So a long and an int are the same. And then a long long is double an int. Cool. And then what is the last type? Yeah, so we learned a little bit about pointers. And regardless of what a pointer is pointing to, it could be a char star or an int star. Always 4 bytes for a pointer. Questions about that? Yes. So a long and an int are the same in the CS50 appliance.
The appliance are completely interchangeable.
Yeah. And so then a long long is double an int. 32-bit, yeah. Yes, if it doesn't explicitly say, you should assume it's 32-bit.
It would say something like, assuming an architecture like the appliance.
Yeah.
For 64-bit, the only things that change are longs and pointers. They both become 8 bytes.
Yes. An unsigned int is also 4 bytes. But what is different about a signed int and an unsigned int? Right. One can represent negative values, but how does it do that? Yeah, it saves 1 bit to represent the sign.
Which one is that? So the sign and the unsigned?
The signed has 1 bit that represents the sign. An unsigned just is all positives.
Okay.
Can
you say that a double is twice the size of a float?
Double is twice the size of a float, yes.
How does a pointer to a long long only?
So the question is, how does the pointer to a long long, how is that only 4 bytes when a long long is 8 bytes? So remember, what is a pointer, essentially, at the very base value? Yeah, so a pointer is just a memory location. So it doesn't matter how much space that pointer is, you know, pointing to. It only needs 4 bytes to keep track of that memory location. Any other questions? So the last thing I have is standard output. These, if you should use them frequently enough that you can remember, but this is when we use printf, for example, and we have like these placeholders, or called format codes. So %c for char, %i for int. We can also use %d. It's the same thing, but generally in CS50 we try to use %i. %f for float. %LLD for long long and %S for string. And similarly, we've been using a few of these escape sequences, for example, \n for newline. This is just for when you're formatting your code for printf. Yes? So the question is, what is %D for? %D is for ints. %D and %I are the same. So question is, what's the difference between \n and \r? I think \r is.
So \r just implies like returns the beginning of the line without actually going to a new line. So if you print a \r, you go back to the beginning of the line, and then if you print more stuff, you overwrite the stuff that's already on this line. Whereas an n actually goes to a new line and goes to the line.
Cool. Any other questions? All right. I'm going to hand it off to Dan, who will continue.
Thank you. Alrighty. So I'll be talking about another wide range of issues or of ideas from the class that are roughly representative of week two and the start of week three. Starting off with casting, which is just a way of treating a value of a certain type as a value of a different type. So we can do this with chars to ints, floats to ints, longs to double. Each of these things can all be, or all of these things can be used as ways of treating some numeric value, plus minus char, as some other numeric value. So there's some issues with this, of course, which comes when you cast things like floats to ints. So this is a little weird. We have a float that is 1.31. We multiply it by 10,000, and then we print it as an int. What does this output? 10,000 times 1.31, so 13,000. Is that the guess? So I'm multiplying it by 10,000 before I'm casting it. You might have some weird digits, and that's... Well, so, right, it's 13, or it's 1.3 times 10,000. So that's 13,000. And this extra weird... 13,100, thank you, Rob. And this extra weirdness, this 9,9, is simply because this casting ended up rounding down where it shouldn't have. Yeah?
So the casting happened after anything else?
So because I have this in parens, right, it does this multiplication before it does this casting.
No parentheses, it would be casting then.
I think it would cast first, yeah, which would be 10,000. Anything else? Cool. So this is 13,099. Why does this happen? Imprecision. Floats aren't perfect. They can only represent numbers to a certain number of significant figures. And so if we print out 8 sig figs on this float, we get a kind of ugly looking number. And that's because 1.31 can't accurately be represented by simple powers of 2 in the machine. And so it ends up taking the closest guess, which ends up being a little low. Make sense? Okay. Now, switches are a different way of doing conditional statements where all we care about is a single variable. So in this particular example, we're getting an integer from the user, and then we're looking at what that integer is. Presumably it's a number between 1 and 4. That's what we're asking for. So you do a switch of the variable name. Then you set up cases of possible values it could be. So case 1, say it's low. And then you break to get out of the switch condition, so you don't keep going. In the next case, so case 2 and case 3, if it's case 2, it just drops down to the first line of code it sees, as with case 3, until it sees a break. So the reason you get case 1 to only print low is because I have this break here. If I, say, ignored this break, if I threw this break away, it would print low, and then it would print middle, and then it would break. So breaks are an important part of switch conditions, and they should be there. Any cases that are not stated explicitly are handled by the default case in the switch and should be treated, or should be cast.
So 1, 2, 3, 4 are meant to be n?
Values that n can be, yes. Yeah.
So if you didn't have that break after the case 1 part,
yeah.
That break, and the user typed in 1,
yeah. You would print low, and then it would print middle, and then it would break.
Why would it print middle if that doesn't fall under case? Because middle comes under case 3.
So everything under a case before a break falls under. So case 1, print is underneath case 1, as is this following print. Well, so this number is just a particular value that this variable can take, right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Yes, case two would print middle and then break. I think any. What other data types can you switch over?
You can switch over any data types, but it only kind of means anything over like chars and ints and stuff like that, because if you're switching over a pointer, that doesn't really make sense. Switching over floats, if it even lets you do that, because of floating point imprecision, you wouldn't really want to do that anyway. So pretty much just ints and chars and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's when you have explicit values that you know a thing can be that a switch is actually useful. Good? Okay. Scope is the range that a declared variable extends. So in this little chunk of code I have, it would be full of errors. And the reason is I declare this int I within the scope of this for loop. And then I'm trying to reference that I outside of that for loop scope. So basically, you can think about scope as anything that you declare within inside a set of curly braces is only exists within those curly braces. And if you try and use that variable outside of those curly braces, you'll get an error from the compiler. Yeah. This doesn't work. Yes. Okay. Strings. String is a char star. They're exactly the same. They are just pointers to characters. And any string that you have should end with \0, which is just a C convention. It is called the null terminator. And null, capital N, capital U, capital L, capital L, is not the same as the null terminator. This is a pointer. This is a character. They are very distinct. Remember it. It will be on the quiz, probably. I haven't seen the quiz. Yes.
What is that? What would null be used?
So if, say, malloc is called when you don't have enough memory to get whatever size you're asking for, mm-hmm. malloc will return null. It's basically whenever a function is supposed to return a pointer, you need to check against null because null is a pretty good... It's sort of the garbage value. It's a zero as far as pointers go, right? Whenever you call a function that returns a pointer, you're going to want to check to be sure that pointer isn't null, because null is a very common, it's sort of a garbage return. So if something didn't go right, just return null instead.
Is there also a null character?
Yes, and that's this.
Yeah, how do you spell it if it's not null?
Spell it as this. It's the null terminator. It's lowercase null if you're spelling it. Yeah.
And I just went back and tested it. Try to put a floating point value into a switch, it'll yell at you saying, statement requires expression of integer type.
Oh, there you go.
So floats don't work.
But yeah, what was the question again?
So, I mean, it's still the same, but it
just doesn't work. So, capital N, capital U, capital L is a actual C thing, right? It is the null pointer and will only be treated as such. If you won't ever try and spell the null character in C any other way than this. Yeah?
So returning char or max or something from the nodes, would that be the same as, like, would it embody the same function as returning null if you did some other char?
So are you referring to, like, returning char max from get char or whatever
it
is? Yeah, so. The general term for all of those things are sentinel values. So like returning int max from get int and char max from get char are just supposed to be like, all right, if these things are returned, you know something went wrong. For pointers, we just happen to have this sentinel value that everyone agrees upon, that this is the thing you return when things go wrong. So char max is what we're using to represent something like null for get char.
So if you if you're testing get char, would you just put null? Would that make a difference?
You couldn't just check null. You'd have to check char max because the return value from the function is a character, not a pointer. And that's actually how string length knows to stop, is because it goes through your array of characters until it sees a null character, and then it's like, all right, I'm done.
Okay, so hello would be five.
Hello would be five. Yep. Okay. So arrays are continuous blocks of memory. They have instant access by saying the name of the array, and then in curly braces, whatever index you want to go to. They're indexed from 0 through n minus the length, or 1 minus the length of the array, or the length of the array minus 1, rather, sorry. And they're declared by the type of the thing that you're storing in the array, the name of the array, and then whatever the size is of that array. So this is a char array of length 6 that has these values. If you have what is going into the array already made, so you could specify this instead as, say, char, whatever the name of your array is, empty brackets, equals curly brace h, comma e, comma l, comma o, comma null character, and curly brace. That would also work as a declaration as this. Then you need to have the size already made. Yes. Alrighty. Command line arguments are a way of getting input from the user as arguments to main. Main takes two arguments, the number of arguments that is being passed along the command line, and a string vector or a string array of all the arguments. And so if I say I called a function such as a dot out 1 space 2 space 3, arg c would be 4, and the arg v 0 would be a dot out, arg v 1 would be 1, arg v 2 would be 2, arg v 3 would be 3 in that particular case. Yeah?
What do you mean by last
element? The last element in the array, because the array is length arg c plus 1 of arg v, the last element is the null pointer. It is arg c plus 1. So it would be in the case that I just said, it would be argv0 is a dot out, argv1 is 1, argv2 is 2, argv3 is 3, argv4, which is 1 larger than the number than argc, would be null. And that's the null pointer. Yes. And that's because string is a char star, is a pointer, and so it has to be the same type. Where is it stored? I don't know where it's stored.
So actually, you know how any function you call, its arguments are stored on the stack? So argc and argv are arguments to main, and they are on the stack, or really just above what you think as the start of the stack. What was the other part of the question?
It's just a different way of getting input from the user. This one's slightly more efficient, and it's handier for scripts because you can just pass arguments to your main function rather than having to wait for users if you say aren't using, if you don't have any users?
And yeah, get strings would be in the heap. They would store the stuff in the heap.
Yeah. Yes, argv0 always includes the dot slash of the function call. Yes, each of the arguments are ended in a null character because they are strings.
But argv argc
is a null pointer. Yes, argv argc is a null pointer.
Hey, Dan,
Can
you keep strings
Like, so the counter key.
Yeah, sorry. So, like, let's say you type in /a.out and then you have 1, 2.
Yep.
If you're asked a question, like, how many commands are there?
So the question is, if the command line, if you had the command line /a.out 1, 2, would the number of command line arguments be 2 or would it be 3? I think, yeah.
I think it doesn't really matter. I would probably say, like, I tend to say, oh, you didn't pass any command line arguments when obviously you called the function. So I tend to vocally exclude the function from the command line arguments, even though it's included in argv. But
if it was on the test, anyway. Yeah. And also, if you say something like argc equals 3, you're in safe standing. Yeah.
So, like, if in this, instead of argc and argv, I made them, like, int a and int b, would that still return the same values? Or would it be, like, something different?
I think if you called... Yeah, so if instead of calling this int argc and string argv brackets, but you kept the same types and just called them something different like a and b, would it still work? And it would still work. You would just, instead of using argc, you'd use a and b. So the question is, getString is going to store memory in the heap because getString is char star. It stores memory in the heap because it calls malloc within the actual implementation of getString. Okay, moving on. Security. So, to be truly secure, you rely on no one. You allow no one access to any of your information, which is why everyone builds their own machines. Their own operating systems, all their programs from scratch, and obviously don't connect to any other machines via the internet. So, computers are insecure. They really are. We have to trust other people, and the idea of security is that you're trying to limit the amount of trust that you need, and one of the means you do that is through cryptography. Cryptography is essentially, we have secrets, sometimes we have to pass our secrets along through, say, the internet or other things, and we don't want people to know these secrets, so we encrypt our secrets into a way that we hope no one can figure out. And so we used, through the course of this class, things like the Caesar cipher and Visionaire, which are both very, very insecure ways of encrypting things. They're easy to figure out what they are or what your secrets are. The real world uses much more complicated encryption schemes. And we won't get into much more than that. Cool. Debugging. GDB is the best. Going to stress this again, use GDB all the time, every time you have a problem. Commands that are useful in GDB are break, which you pass either a line number, a function name, essentially where in your code you want to stop and be able to take control. Print, which prints whatever, print takes a variable and prints out whatever that variable is at that point in your execution. Next moves your execution along one step. And steps inside a function in your execution. Other things are like run, which is how you actually run your code, continue takes all the steps needed to get to the next breakpoint, and there are many, many others. Look them up. They're great. Yes, which is a debugger. So a debugger is a program that lets you debug your program. Yeah, it's not a program that finds bugs for you. Though that would be great. Okay, and last for me is search. So the types of search that we talked about in this class are linear search, which is just that you look through each element of the search space one element at a time until you find what you're looking for, or until you reach the end of your search space, at which point you say that you couldn't find the element that you were looking for. And this takes, at best, constant time, which is O of 1, and at worst, linear time, which is O of n. Binary search, which needs sorted elements, you go to the middle of your element, see if the element you're looking for is larger or smaller than the element that you're at the middle. If it's larger, you say that the bottom of your search space is your current location, the middle, and you restart the process. If it's smaller, you look to the, or you say that the, yeah, what's up? Yes. Any sort of sort that's been taught in the class is fair game for the test.
Merge sort?
Merge sort. And the fact that you haven't had to do it for a problem set, it's fair game for the test.
We go over
it will be gone over.
If you look at the practice, problem in the merge sort page of study.cs50.net, there is the code for implementing merge sort, so you don't have to implement it yourself tonight. But make sure you understand it rather than just memorizing it. The merge sort page on study.cs50.net, there is a practice problem that if you click through the problem at the very end, there is a solution, which is the merge sort implementation. But make sure you understand it rather than just memorizing it or copying it down.
Okay. And like a perfectly valid problem for the exam would be something like, here's a list. What does this list look like after one step of selection sort or insertion sort or whatever? One full iteration over the list. So even if you don't end up needing to code for it, you need to understand it enough to know how it's going to be modifying this array.
Okie doke. That's it for me.
Hey everyone, my name is Lucas. I'm going to talk about recursion, all the sorts that we have learned, and a little bit about pointers. Okay, so first of all, recursion. What does it mean to say that a function is recursive?
Calls itself.
Yeah. So like this picture, for example, it's like the picture inside of the picture, and so on. So, for example, you can have as Dan was talking about binary search. One way in which binary search is recursive is the fact that you're trying to find a number, so you go to the middle, and then you check if the number is there, in the left, or in the right. And then if you find out that the number is going to be on the left, it's the same thing as doing the search again, but just on the left of the list. So that's how it sounds like it's recursive. So that's why you guys have a recursive solution for merge sort. Okay. So here's an example. So let's say that I want to sum all the numbers from 1 to n. I can realize that the sum of the n numbers is n plus m, n minus 1 up to 1. But then if I look at n minus 1 plus n minus 2 plus 1, that's the same thing as summing numbers up to n minus 1. So I can say the sum of n equals sum equals n plus the sum of n minus 1. Does that make sense? And I also would have something as called the base case, which is that the sum of the numbers up to 0 would be 0. So as soon as I get to the number 0, I stop counting. Does that make sense? So here's an example of how we could implement that. So I have this function int sum that takes an integer n. So here I first check if n is less or equals to 0. So if it's less or equals to 0, I return 0, which is our base case. Otherwise, I can just return n plus the sum of the numbers from n minus 1, from 1 to n minus 1. Make sense? OK. So here's what it looks like. You have sum of 2 equals 2 plus the sum of 1. And sum of 1 is 1 plus the sum of 0, which is 0. Make sense? So if we look at the stack of your program, this is what it looks like. First, you have the main function, and then the main function called sum2. And then sum2 is going to say, oh, sum2 equals 2 plus the sum of 1. So I add sum of 1 to the stack. And then sum of 1 is going to call sum of 0, which is also going to be added to the stack. And then each of these ones that are on top of another have to return before the other ones can keep going. So for example, here, sum of 0 first is going to return 0, and then to sum of 1. Then sum of 1 is going to return 1 to sum of 2. And finally, sum of 2 is going to return 3 to main. Does that make sense? It's really important to understand like how the stack is working and like try to see if it makes sense. OK, so sorting. So why is sorting important, first of all? Why should we care? Anyone? An example? Yeah? Yeah, OK. So we can search more efficiently. That's a good way. So for example, we have a lot of things, actually, like in our lives that are sorted. For example, dictionaries. It's very important to have like all the words in some kind of order that we can access easily. So that's what he was saying. You can search more efficiently. Think of how hard it would be to have a dictionary in which the words are in random order. You'll have to look at pretty much every single word until you find the word that you're looking for. If you're using Facebook also, when you're looking at your friends, you're going to see that Facebook puts your closer friends on top of like the ones that you don't talk to that much. You're going to see if you go all the way to the bottom of your friend list, you're going to see people that you probably don't even remember that you're friends with. And that's because Facebook does like kind of sorts your friends based on how close you are to them. So organizing data, also Pokemon, so like you see that like all Pokemons have numbers, and that's an easy way of accessing data. Yeah. Yep. Okay, so selection sort. So selection sort is going to select the smallest unsorted value of a list in each iteration. It's kind of like the sort that you do in your head when you're trying to sort a list on hand. Basically, what you do is you look for the smallest number, you put in like in the sorted list, and then you look for the next smallest number, and then you keep doing that, and so on. So selection sort is basically you select every time the smallest unsorted value, put in the front of the put at the end of the sorted part of the list, and keep doing that. So let's quickly see what this looks like. So here's the sorted and unsorted list. So for the sorted list, is initially empty, and then I'm going to select the smallest number here, which is 2. So I get the number 2 and I put it in the front of the list. And then I look for the next smallest element, which is 3, so I put at the end of the sorted list. And then I keep doing that. I find 4, put at the end, find 5, put at the end. And look at how all of those times that I'm saying put at the end is basically swapping two values. Okay. And then the last one, you just have one more element, so it's already sorted. Okay, so insertion sort. Insertion sort, you're going to have also that thing of having a sorted and an unsorted list. The only thing is that the unsorted list is going to, that every time that you're adding an element to the sorted list, you just pick the element that is in front of the unsorted list, and then you're going to find what position it should be in the sorted part of the list. Let's see what this is, so this makes more sense. So initially, for example, I'm trying to insert the number 3 in the sorted part of the list. So the list doesn't have anything, so I can just put the number 3. Now I want to add the number 5 to the sorted part of the list. So I look at the number 5, I notice that it's greater than 3, so I know that it has to be after 3. So I put 3 and 5. Then I want to insert the number 2. I notice that the number 2 is actually less than both 3 and 5, so I actually have to put it all the way in the beginning of the list. So I have to kind of shift all the elements in the sorted list so I can make room for the number 2. Then I see the number 6, I see that it should be after 5, so I put it there. And finally, I look at the number 4, and I notice it should be between 3 and 5, and then I put it there and shift all the other elements. Make sense? Bubble sort. So bubble sort is basically what you're going to do. We call it bubble sort because you go through the list. It's actually better if I just show you like this. You go through the list, and you're going to compare adjacent numbers, and you're going to swap their positions if they're not in the right order. So basically what is going to happen is, here, for example, you have 8 and 6. You know that the sorted order would actually be 6 and 8, right? So you're going to swap their orders. Then I see 8 and 4 here, and I do the same thing. I swap again. And finally, 2 and 8, I also swap them. It's called bubble sort because after each out of these iterations, actually the largest number in the list gets all the way to the end of the list. Does that make sense? Because it keeps swapping it and moving it to the right. Okay, so this is the second iteration will be the same thing. I'll do one swap, and then the last one, I notice that there are no swaps and the list is sorted. So in bubble sort, we basically keep going through the list and swapping things until I notice that I didn't do any swaps doing that iteration, which means that the list is already sorted. Make sense? Let's talk a little bit about running time. So do you guys remember what big O, omega, and theta are? Yeah? OK. What is big O, first of all? Yeah, it's called the worst case runtime, which just means that it's how much you expect the program to take to run, like in terms of, in this case, n, like the number of elements in the list, in the worst case, like in the worst possible case. So for bubble sort, for example, we have big O of n squared. Why do we have that? Why is bubble sort big O n squared? Yeah. So you have to, so the worst case will be that I'll have to do n iterations. So like each of the iterations is going to bring the largest element to the end of the list. So the worst case is that I have to do that thing n times. And for each of these times, I have to do n swaps because I have to compare each two elements. So that's why it's n squared, because it's n times n. Then selection sort, it's also n squared, because for each iteration, I have to look at every single element in the list and then find the smallest, which means that I have to look through n elements, and I have to do that n times, because I have to select all the n elements. An insertion sort is also n squared, because the worst case scenario will be, one, I have to insert n numbers, right? So I already know that I'm going to have n iterations. But for each of those numbers, if I had to like look at all of the numbers in the sorted list and put it like all the way in the front, that will be n squared, because it will be n times n again. Make sense? What about omega? It's the best case scenario. So it's like, and a lot of times for sorting, the best case scenario is when the list is already sorted, so you don't really have to do anything. Bubble sort has the best case scenario of n. Do you guys know why? Yeah, it's just if you keep track of whether the iteration had any swaps or not, if you have like a, something like set to true, if there was an iteration. If the list is already sorted, basically what is going to happen is I'm going to try to swap all like each two adjacent elements. I'm going to see that there are no swaps, and I just return right away. So it means that I just had to go through the list one time. So it's n, because I look at n elements. Why selection sort n square? Yeah, even if the list is sorted, I still have to, for every number in the list, I have to, no, for every iteration of selection sort, I have to select the minimum element. So it means that I have to look at all the elements in the unsorted list and find the minimum for each iteration. Does that make sense? And insertion sort is n, because in the case that I'm trying to insert the numbers and all of the numbers, when I try to insert them, I see that they are already in the right position. I don't have to like go check all the other numbers in the unsorted list. So that's why it will be n. Make sense? And what is theta? What, sorry? Exactly. So here you can see the only selection sort and merge sort have thetas. And just because you only have theta if both big O and omega are the same. Okay. And finally, merge sort is n log n. And then as Dan was saying, merge sort is kind of like the same way that you do binary search, right? So you get the list, and you're like going to cut in halves and then you cut them in smaller halves, and then you like merge them. You guys remember that, right? Okay, as he was saying. Okay, pointers. So what is a pointer? An address. Okay. I know that David like shows a bunch of videos of like Binky and like things like pointing at each other, but I like to think of like pointers as like merely an address. So it's a variable that is going to store an address. So it's just like this special variable that is 4 bytes long. Remember that a pointer to anything is always 4 bytes long for a 32-bit machine. So the case of the appliance. It just has like the location of a variable inside of it. Okay, so this is memory, basically. So each block of memory actually has kind of like a label, which is the address of the slot in memory. So that means that I can have a pointer pointing to like any of these addresses. So the reason why I would use pointers is if I have to remember the location that a specific variable is in memory. And you guys remember that one of those cases was if I actually want to do swap for reals, I actually have to send a pointer, not the variable. Do you guys remember that? The difference between calling by value and calling by reference, right? Okay, yeah. So call by value, when you just send a variable to a function, you're just sending a value, so you're actually sending a copy of the variable, and your program like couldn't care less about if it's like the same variable actually makes a copy. And calling by reference means that I'm actually sending a copy of the pointer to that variable. So it means that I'm sending the location of that variable. So since I have the location of the variable when I call the function with pointers, I'm able to actually change the data that was in main. Make sense? Because it's not, although the pointer is a copy, the pointer still has the real address of the variable that I want you to change. Make sense? So creating pointers, remember that pointers always have like the type that it's pointing to and then a star, and then you put the name. So remember that whenever you have whatever star, it's like a pointer to that whatever variable type that you had. So here in star, for example, it's a pointer to an integer. And then char star is a pointer to a char, and so forth. And yeah?
If we have a pointer to like int star x, I know that creates a pointer to x. Does it also declare x as an integer?
OK, so when you say int star x, you're not creating a pointer to a variable x. You're creating a pointer named x. Yeah. So when I say int star x, I'm saying, hey, in memory, I'm going to get one of these three boxes, and I'm going to say that that is going to be a x, which is going to be a pointer. Okay. And the reason, and something interesting about pointers is that, so we say that they are 4 bytes for a 32-bit machine, and the reason for that is because 4 bytes are 32 bits, and machines that are 64 bits, they actually have pointers addresses that have, they're at 64 bits long, so it just means that the size of the addresses in the machine is different. So referencing and dereferencing. There are two operators that you guys should remember. The first is ampersand, the second is star. Don't get confused by that star and this star, because remember that in this case, you have int star. It's like a whole thing together. There's no like int space star. So it means that it's the type. Remember that like when you have like the variable star, you're talking about the type. When you have just a star and the name of the variable, it means that you're dereferencing the pointer, which means that you're looking at the pointer, finding the address it's pointing to, going to that address, and looking at the whatever you have there. So I tell my students that when you have star, you should think that this is the abbreviation of content of. So if you have a pointer and you do star pointer, it's the content of the pointer. So you go to whatever it's pointing to and look at the content. And the ampersand is the same thing as address of. So if I have a variable a, like a, let's say that I did int a equals 3, if I want to find the address of that variable a in memory, I can just do ampersand a. So it's address of a. Make sense? So here's an example. So if I do, this is missing int b and int c. So int a equals 3 means that I'm going to go to memory, and I'm going to find a slot and put the number 3 here. And then int b equals 4, I'm going to do the same thing, go to memory and put a number 4 in one of the boxes. And int c equals 5, find another box and put the number 5. So what is this line doing now? Int star pa equals ampersand a. So first of all, int star pa, what is it doing? Yeah, so int star pa first declares a pointer called PA, and then it's assigning the value of that pointer to be the address of A, so ampersand A. Then if I do star PB, what is star PB? Oh, sorry. This is also missing. Int star PB and int star PC. I'm so sorry. It's the same thing, but now I'm creating a pointer to B and then a pointer to C. Yeah? Yes. So PA, if you go to memory and you go to the box that is designated for PA, you're actually going to see an address of A. Okay? Okay, yeah?
So the pointer is an address.
Yeah, pointer is an address. Never forget that. It's like the most important part about pointers, is that like they're storing an address to some variable. Anything else? Any other questions? Okay, so pointers and arrays. Remember that when I do int array 3, basically what I'm doing is I'm kind of like declaring a pointer like array is kind of like a pointer to a specific place in memory in which I allocated 3 slots for integers. Does that make sense? So when I do int array 3, what I'm doing basically is creating 3 slots in memory. So I just find 3 slots in memory. So if I do then a star array, it basically means the content of array, which means I go to the place. So like I erase the pointer, I go to that place that is pointing to, and I put the number 1. And then if I do star array plus 1, that's the same thing as doing array brackets 1, which just means I go to the place that it's pointing at, and then the plus 1 makes me shift one position. So I go to this position actually and put the number 2. And then finally, when I do array plus 2, I go to where array's pointing at, and then I move 2 memory blocks, and then I put the number 3 here. Yeah?
So star array is simply saying the very, very first point. And we can add 1 just because we're only really referencing that first address.
Yeah. So that's also the same reason why do we, for example, say array 0, array 1, array 2? Like, one of the reasons is, why do you do like 0, 1, 2, 3 instead of like 1, 2, 3? One of the reasons is, one, computer programmers prefer to start counting from 0. 2 is because when you do array 0, it's the same thing as doing array plus 0, which means I go to that position and I don't skip any memory blocks. So I don't move any memory blocks. Yeah? One of the differences is that first, when you do, so she's asking what is the difference between doing this or doing malloc. One of the differences is that int array 3 is creating an array on the stack, and when I do malloc, it creates on the heap. Does that make sense? So how does malloc actually work? So why do we even need to use malloc? Basically, when your program is compiled, like your compiler kind of like figures out all the variables that you declared, and it creates space for all of them in the stack. So all of your variables are going to be somewhere in the stack. So here's like the environment variables. So basically, space for those variables in memory is allocated at compile time. So it means that your computer has to know all of those variables beforehand. It doesn't need to know what value you're going to put in them, but it needs to know how much memory you need. But now let's say that, for example, you're creating an array or like taking a string, and you don't know exactly like that you're taking from the user. You don't know how long the string is going to be, for example. So you don't know exactly how many memory blocks you allocate, right? So it doesn't really make sense for you to say, oh, put 100 characters. And then what if the user writes 150? You're going to be screwed. So you cannot be sure of how much memory you need to allocate when you compile the program. You just know that on runtime. So that's why you have the heap. So the heap actually is going to have memory that you're allocating during the duration of the program running. So basically, when you do malloc, what you're doing is allocating memory at runtime, which means that you're deciding right at that moment that you should have that memory. So that's when you're allocating it. Does it make sense? So remember, the stack has variables that are created on compile time, and then the heap has variables that are like created as you go with malloc, for example. So getString is going to call malloc. So actually, like this is malloc. Let me talk about malloc and I'll explain getString. So malloc is kind of like it's the same thing as memory allocation. So it's going to allocate memory on the heap, and it's going to return a pointer to where that memory was allocated at. So when you do like int star, so here for example, int star pointer and then pointer equals malloc size of int times 10. I'm creating a pointer, and then I'm assigning that pointer to the value of the pointer that malloc is giving me. So I'm asking malloc, can you allocate space for 10 integers? That's what it's saying. And malloc gives me back a pointer to that place. Make sense? Okay. And getString is basically doing a call to malloc so you can allocate memory during runtime. Always remember to check for no, because malloc is going to return no if it cannot allocate memory. Let's say that you ask for a ridiculous amount of memory, your computer is not going to be able to allocate that much, so malloc is just going to return no. So always remember to check if the pointer that you got from malloc is no or not, because if it is, you might be dereferencing a pointer and causing seg faults. And finally, don't forget your free memory. If you don't free memory at the end of the program, no, sorry, malloc is like creating memory in the heap, and you have to free that memory before the program ends. Okay, that's all for me. Sorry, Rob. Thanks. Any last questions before Rob comes? No? Yeah? I think Dave is uploading it soon. It'll be online. It's up? Okay. Yeah? Yes. You should free all the memory that is put in the heap. Yes. Anytime that you have a call to malloc, you should have a call to free after you stop using that variable. So kind of malloc and free are always together. They're best friends. Yeah. Rob?
I'll go quickly, and also the video will be put up, so I have the mic on. Okay, so week 5 stuff. First thing we have is the stack. So remember that there's going to be one stack frame per active function call. We'll see that in a second. And also remember what actually goes in each stack frame are going to be the local variables of our functions, the arguments that are passed into our functions, along with a couple other things you don't really need to worry about. So here is an example program where notice main is printfing the return value of foo4. Foo is just going to return the value of bar 4, 6. And bar is going to set some local variable n equal to 4 times 6, and then return n. So let's look at the stack throughout the actual iteration of this program. So there's the bottom of our stack. Remember that the stack grows up. So at the bottom of our stack, we have a stack frame for main. When the program starts, main is always going to be at the bottom of our stack. And what is inside of our stack frame for main? So even though there are no local variables to main, like I said before, we have argc and argv taking up space inside of main, main's stack frame. So main is now going to call the function foo. And that means foo is going to get its own stack frame. So now we're inside of the function foo. And what needs to go in foo's stack frame? Well, foo has an argument n. And n is equal to 4, since that's what main is passing as foo's argument. So now foo is going to call bar. What is bar going to have as inside of its stack frame? It has x equal to 4, y equal to 6. That's not all that we're going to have in the stack frame, because bar also has a local variable n, and n we're going to set equal to 24. So now bar is going to return n. So bar is returning 24 to the stack frame foo. And because bar is now returning, that means we're popping the stack frame for bar off of the stack. So all of the memory that bar had been using is now off the stack. Now foo is also going to return 24 to main. So now that foo is returning, the memory that foo was using in its stack frame is also gone. And now main is going to call printf. So printf is just another function. When we call printf, it's going to be another stack frame for the printf function call. What are we passing printf? That's what's going to go in its stack frame. At the very least, we're passing that %i backslash n and the argument 24. It might have more in its stack frame if printf happens to be using some local variables. We don't know. But all that goes in printf stack frame. It's going to execute the printf. Then printf's done. It will return. Finally, main is done. Main will return. And then our program is done. Yeah? So there's a subtle difference between arguments and parameters. And really, in common speak, people tend to just mix them up all the time. But parameters are like the formal name of the thing. So like argc and argv are the parameters to main. Arguments are what you actually pass in as those parameters. So there when I call foo of 4, 4 is the argument I'm passing in. And the parameter n inside of foo takes on the value 4, since 4 was the argument. N is a local variable to bar. But foo's n is still local to foo, but it's a parameter to foo. It's not a local variable. Yeah?
So what is foo doing here?
Foo is just calling bar and returning whatever bar returns.
Okay, so it's just for
yeah, just to see multiple stack frames and, yeah.
Why was foo called before printf?
So I could have instead done something like int x equals foo of 4 and then printed x. But instead, I combined the function call into the printf argument. But notice that we can't actually execute the call to printf until we figure out what foo of 4 is. So we're going to evaluate this. And only once that's done are we going to come back and evaluate this. They totally should be int. That was not caught over multiple passes. So it should be int bar and int foo, since both of those are returning integers. Void is only if they're not going to return actual values. Yeah? A line above the return. So inside of foo, if we had a printf right here, so if we had a printf right here, it would print once. Since we are calling foo once right here, then we'll hit the printf, then we'll call bar, and then foo will return, and that's it. We only ever encounter the printf once. So in theory, isn't printf calling foo? So no, just the order that C is going to execute these things is before we can call a function, all of the arguments to the function have to be completely evaluated. And so is this completely evaluated? Yes, it's just a string. It's just a value. Then we have to completely evaluate this. Once this is done, now all of its arguments are evaluated, and now we can make the call to printf. You do not need a return semicolon if you have a void function. Okay. So now some heap stuff. So heap is how we're going to deal with dynamic memory management. And this directly contrasts with the stack, which we would call automatic memory management. So on the stack, you never really have to deal with how the local variables are being pushed and popped off all these stack frames and all that stuff. You don't have to worry about it. It's automatic. So the stack is, or the heap is manual. So and the manualness comes from these functions malloc and free. And so here's another program. All we're doing is mallocing an integer. We're storing it in star x. Of course, we have to check to see if x is null. Then we're going to just set what x is pointing to 50, print the value inside of x, print what x is pointing to, print x, and then free x. So how is this actually going to look if we look at our stack and heap? So we'll start again. The bottom of our stack as before. Remember that the heap directly opposes the stack. So we're going to have the top of our heap up there. So the bottom of our stack, we have our stack frame for main. It has the space for argc, argv, and we now have a local variable x, which is an int star. So we're going to iterate through this program. First thing we have is a call to malloc. So we're making a call to malloc. Malloc is a function. It's going to get a stack frame. What are we passing to malloc? That's going to go inside of the stack frame. We're passing size of int, which is 4. And so that is inside of that is passed to malloc. Malloc now, what does malloc do? It grabs us some space on the heap. So we're going to go to the heap, and we're going to grab 4 bytes from the heap. So let's just give that an arbitrary address, 0x123. That's just pretend that is an address that is on the heap. So what is actually inside of that region of memory at address 0x123? Garbage. So we have not stored anything in it. So as far as we know, it can be anything. You shouldn't assume it's 0. It's most likely not 0. So now malloc returns. And what do we do when malloc returns? We set what it returns. We set x equal to what it is returning. And so what is it returning? It's returning 0x123, since that is the address of the block of memory that it just allocated in the heap. So return 0x123. X is now going to be set equal to 0x123, which pictorially we frequently draw as like X having an actual arrow pointing to that block. But X is just storing that address. So Now we have to check if x is null. It's not null. We pretended that malloc succeeded. Okay, so now star x equals 50. So star, remember, it means go to that address. So 0x123, we're going to go to that address. So that brings us up there. What are we doing at that address? We're storing 50. And so after this line, that is what things are going to look like. So now it's no longer garbage up there. Now we know that 50 is in that particular address because we set it to that. Okay, so now we're going to print f. So first we're going to print star x. And so what is star x? Again, star x means go to the thing that x is pointing to. So x is storing 0x123. Go to that. We get 50. So print f that. And that means it's going to print 50. And then that returns. And then we have the second printf. We're now %p, if you haven't seen it. That's just how you print a pointer. So we have %i, %f, all of those already. So %p, print a pointer. So x is a pointer. So if we're going to print x itself, we're printing what is actually inside x, which is 0x123. So the first printf is going to print 50. The second printf is going to print 0x123. Yeah. So percent, do you use percent x to print a pointer? So you can, but percent x is just generally for, like, if you have an integer, you have some integer, and you want to print it as a hexadecimal. Like, it's just, that's just how you do that, whereas percent d would print it as decimal. That's where we get percent d. I is just integer. Percent p is specifically for pointers. So x is a pointer. We want to use percent p. But percent x could work. Yeah, so when we, at least for this call, so I didn't include it in here, but these two arguments are necessarily inside of this stack frame, along with any local variables printf happens to be using. And then the next call to printf, now inside a printf stack frame is %p backslash n, and whatever the value of x is, which is 0x123. It'll print in it'll print something that looks like this. So it prints it in address form. It looks like an address. Yeah. Why is what? Why is this pointer 4 bytes? So there are a whole bunch of zeros in front of this. So it's really 0x00000123. On a 64-bit system, there would be a whole bunch of more zeros. So the first printf is going to print, yes, it's going to print what x is pointing to. Star x says what, or star says, what is this thing pointing to? Grab it. So what is it pointing to? 50, grab it, that's what we're going to print. Whereas the next one, we're just printing x itself. What is inside of x? 0x123. Okay, and then finally we have the free. What are we passing to free? We're passing x. That time I actually displayed it in the stack frame. So we're passing the value 0x123 to free. So now free knows, all right, I have to go up to the heap and free that memory. It's no longer using what is at address 0x123. And so free is going to release that from the heap. Now our heap is empty again. We have no memory leaks. Now free will return. Notice that x is still 0x123, but that is now not valid memory. We no longer should use that. We should no longer dereference x. Yeah.
Is return 0 redundant?
Is return 0 redundant? Yes. We just put that there because like we have a return 1 for error, so it's like, yeah, let's include the return 0. So after free x, what happens if we try to dereference the pointer? It's possible that nothing goes wrong. It's possible that we'll still get 50. It's possible also that that memory is now being used for something else. So it's undefined behavior, and undefined means anything can happen. Yeah. No, so if you assign x to something else, so if right here we said x equals malloc something else, malloc size of int, then that original block of memory is not freed and we have officially lost it. That is a memory leak. We've lost all references to that block of memory, so there's no way we can ever free it. Okay, so then return zero, main's done. All right, so Stack Overflow. What's the idea here? So remember, heap is growing down, stack is growing up. So if this was the example from lecture, I think, where main is just going to call this function foo, which is going to call itself recursively over and over again. So stack frames are going to work exactly the same. So we're going to start with main as the bottom stack frame. Then main is going to call foo, which is going to get a stack frame. Then foo is going to call foo again, which is going to get another stack frame. And then again, and again, and again, and again, until eventually we run into the heap. So this is how we get a stack overflow. And at this point, you'd seg fault. Or you'd really seg fault before this point, but yeah. So core dump, you'll see like segmentation fault core dumped. A core dump is just like you get a core dump when you seg fault. And it's just a way, it's like a dump of all of the contents of your current memory so that you can try and identify why you seg faulted. Yeah. So a segmentation fault means there's a stack overflow. So not necessarily. A segmentation fault means you're touching memory in a way you shouldn't be. So one way of that happening is when you stack overflow, we start touching memory that we shouldn't be, or in a way that we shouldn't be. So inside of an infinite loop, like this is like a recursive infinite loop, and so we get another stack frame each time. But just inside of a regular infinite, like while one print, well, let's not even printf, while one do something, whatever, we're not going to be getting another stack frame. We're just going to keep looping over this single instruction. The stack isn't growing. It's the fact that each recursive call is giving us a stack frame. That's why we get a stack overflow. So if inside of the while loop there was a printf, you still would not seg fault. I just didn't want to confuse things. It would just, it would loop. You'd get a single stack frame for the printf. Then printf would return. Then you'd loop again. You get a single stack frame for the printf. It would return. Single stack frame. And so you're not getting this infinite piling of stack frames. Yes. So this stack overflow happens because none of these calls to foo are returning. So if we returned, then we would start losing stack frames, and then we would not stack overflow. And that's why you need a base case for your recursive functions. Yeah?
Is the potential size of the stack and the heap the same for all programs?
Roughly. Is the potential size of the stack and the heap the same for all programs? Roughly. There's some randomization to where the stack starts and where the heap starts. If you happen to have a whole lot of like global variables and things, you might take away from some space for your heap. On a 64-bit system, you virtually have infinite memory. There's just so much that, like between 32 bits and 64 bits, that is a significant difference, that you're going to get a whole lot more stack and heap space on a 64-bit system, because there's just more addresses that they can use. But on an individual system, it'll be roughly the same amount of stack and heap space. All right. So last thing is compilation. So you should know this process. There are four big steps. So first one should be easy to remember, pre-processing. It has the word pre in it, or the prefix pre, so it comes before everything else. The thing to remember is the hash. So hash defines and hash includes and all of those are all preprocessor directives. These are the things that the preprocessor takes care of. So what does the preprocessor do? It's a really dumb thing. All it's capable of are all of these copy and cut and paste operations. So hash includes standard io.h. What is that doing? It's grabbing the standard io.h file and pasting it into the top wherever it says hash include standard io.h. And any hash define that we've seen, what is that doing? It's copying the value that the hash define is defined as and pasting that wherever you're using the value. So the preprocessor just does really simple text-based operations. It does nothing smart. So everything else is more complicated. So now that preprocessing is done, we actually compile. So what does compiling mean? We're now going from C code to assembly code. Yeah?
Apparently there was a function that was a void function, but it was returning something.
Yeah, we caught that. Okay. Yeah. So compiling, we're going from C to assembly. So this is an actual language change. Compiling itself means going from like a higher level language to a lower level language. And so C is a high level language compared to assembly. What is assembly? It's instructions that are pretty much made for your CPU. But your computer still does not understand assembly. It only understands ones and zeros. So the next step is assembling, which brings us from these instructions that your CPU understands and actually translates them to the ones and zeros. So C to assembly to binary. But I don't have an executable yet. So think of like the CS50 library. We have provided you with a binary for the CS50 library, which has get string and get int and all that. But the CS50 library in and of itself is not executable. It does not have a main function. It's just a bunch of binary that you can use. And so linking is how we linking is how we bring together all of these different binary files into an actual executable, one that you can type .a.out. And so this is like the file that you wrote, whatever your program is, caesar.c, but now it's been compiled down to binary, so caesar.o. And this is our CS50 library's binary, and they're being combined into a single executable. Yeah? So first include, remember that the hash include is actually a preprocessor step, but that's separate. If you're not using any functions that are outside of your single file, then no, you don't need to link anything since everything is just, you have everything. That said, like printf is being linked in. If you ever use printf, that's something that needs to be linked in because you didn't write that. And in fact, printf is automatically linked in. You know how at the command line, when you type make, you see it have like -lcs50, which says link in the CS50 library? Printf and stuff like that is going to be linked in automatically. Okay, any other questions on anything? Linking, we have a whole bunch of different binary files. So CS50 library, this is the canonical example that we use, is CS50 library. We have compiled and given to you the binary for the CS50 library. You want to use getString in your program. So you go and use getString, but when I compile, without my binary code for getString, when you compile your code down, you can't actually run your program because getString is not yet completely defined. It's only when you link in my binary that contains getString that now, all right, I can actually execute getString, my file is complete, and I can run this. Yeah?
Does linking convert the binary to executable? So even if you don't have other libraries, wouldn't it still be necessary to translate the file to executable?
So an executable is still in binary. It's just combining a whole bunch of binaries.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Any other questions? Otherwise, we're all set. All right, thanks.